So what are you supposed to do between each Engadget podcast? Wait in silence? I'm Matt Smith, and every morning I walk through the day's biggest tech stories. It's short, relevant, and ready for listening whenever you wake up. Find Engadget Morning Edition wherever you find your podcasts, or ask your smart speaker for the latest news from Engadget.
What's up, Internet, and welcome back to the Engadget Podcast. I'm Senior Editor Devendra Hardwar.
I'm Reviews at... I'm Deputy Editor
Shogi. See? It's hard, because it's like ingrained.
I'm Deputy Editor Sherlyn Lowe.
Are you? I'm confused right now, Sherlyn. Today, folks, we will be talking about a surprisingly big deal. Out of nowhere, Sony announced that it's buying Bungie, the developer of Destiny and the original developer of Halo, which is now a whole Microsoft thing, so that's really confusing. And we'll talk about what that means for the gaming landscape, and also, hey, there's a lot of consolidation going on. What does this all mean? Jessica Conda is going to join us to talk about that. And also, afterwards, we're going to be diving into the continued troubles around Joe Rogan that Spotify is facing. So we talked a bit about that last week, but there is more stuff happening. So let's break that down and figure out what's up with Spotify. As always, if you're enjoying the Engadget podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes, subscribe to us on your podcatcher of choice, and drop us an email at podcast@engadget.com. We typically record live on Thursdays around 10 a.m. Eastern. You can join us on our YouTube stream there. For the chat room, we'll have some Q&A. Sometimes we show off devices. It's a fun time. Let's move on to our first big story this week. Out of nowhere, we learned that Sony is buying Bungie, the developer behind Destiny 2, the original developer behind Halo, for $3.6 billion. And joining us to talk about this news is Jessica Conda, senior editor at Engadget. Hey, Jess, how's it going?
Hello. Happy to be here once again with acquisition news. Yeah, you said this was out of, it was out of nowhere, but like, this is it, dude. We got to get used to just big deals happening over and over.
This is what's happening. It does feel like this is a direct response to the last time you were on, when Microsoft announced that they were buying Activision Blizzard for a lot more.
$69 billion.
Yeah.
Nice.
So
how could you forget that number, man?
How could you forget it? I think in the grand landscape of things, normally this deal, we'd be like, whoa, man, look at how much money Sony's paying for Bungie. Like, look how big this deal is. But in comparison to that Activision Blizzard deal, it really pales in comparison. So Jess, like, what were your thoughts first hearing about this? Because I'm sure this wasn't like a direct response to Activision Blizzard. A deal like this takes a while to kind of get moving. But what are your feelings about this? And what does this mean for the gaming landscape?
Right. So you're absolutely correct. If this had happened before the Activision news, this would have been a much bigger deal. Like, it would have been, oh, wow, okay, now we're really building up to something. Instead, the Activision deal was like, okay, we're here. And now this makes sense in a world where large, large studios are buying large studios. So this deal was probably in the works for about 6 months before it actually landed. So in terms of it being a response to Activision, that's not really the case. This is just what's happening, and these deals are happening behind the scenes. SIE president, so Sony president, Jim Ryan, he said that there are definitely more acquisitions in Sony's future. They're working on deals now. We know the other studios like Microsoft, they're definitely doing that too. Just keep expecting these kinds of genre shifting, platform shifting deals to keep happening. But in terms of Bungie being owned by Sony, that is, it's shocking. Like, that was a shocking deal. Yeah, because Bungie is the Microsoft studio. Bungie is the the arbiter of Halo.
The Halo. Like,
this is the Halo studio. Well, it was once upon a time, right? But like, for 10 years, basically, they were the Halo studio. They did the original Halo. So that's a cornerstone of Xbox. They were Xbox for years, and then they split. They cut a deal with Activision to publish Destiny for a while. They cut that deal short, actually. Yeah, isn't that funny?
So that was originally a 10-year deal for Destiny, and that. So I guess Destiny 1 sales will still, which may still happen or something, but that would go through Activision, which means it would be going through Microsoft eventually.
Right, so
for Destiny 1. Weird.
I don't even know how the like royalties are going to shake out for all this stuff. So now Microsoft is going to own Activision. So it's going to be Microsoft and Activision, two former Bungie publishers under one roof. And then Bungie is now at Sony, the rival company. Obviously, it's a very different world than it was when Halo Combat Evolved came out. And there are a lot of studios that used to be tied with Microsoft that are now at Sony and vice versa, right? Like, this is, the industry has shifted. But this is a pretty big one. Bungie at Sony is, I mean, kind of nuts. If you had told high school me this news, I would, I don't know. I don't know if I could compute it. Yeah.
There's a lot. The gaming world has changed since we were in high school, I guess, too. It's like when I was in high school, that was Dreamcast era, PlayStation 1 era. And it was like, Microsoft getting to consoles? No way. But yeah, now they're a significant player. What does this mean for Sony, Jess? Because I feel like Bungie does not make the kind of games Sony studios typically do, right? Like, they're more into the big budget, single player stuff like Uncharted and Last of Us. And what Bungie is bringing is a live service game like mm-hmm. Destiny 2. I guess that's something entirely new for Sony, so I could see the appeal there.
Well, yeah, and that's exactly why they bought Bungie. So Sony is looking to beef up their live online like games as a service platform. They want to build more of these immersive living experiences like Destiny. And Bungie knows how to do that. So this is really kind of a collaboration from that angle. Sony's going to learn a lot from Bungie. They're going to get access to this kind of infrastructure that Bungie has in terms of supporting live games, huge live games. And then Bungie is also talking about not just doing games. They're going to use this deal to push into other forms of multimedia, which, you know, I assume streaming TV, film, just like, you know, Halo's getting the show. Why not one of Bungie's platforms? Why not, or one of Bungie's franchises? They only have Destiny right now. So there's going to be some new stuff coming down the line. But that'll be years and years down the line.
Also, it seems like, wasn't the news around Destiny 2, that was supposed to be like a 10-year game, right? Mm-hmm. And you know what's weird? We're getting to the end of that 10-year game cycle to come to think of it, which is wild for me to even consider right now.
Yeah, like, that sounds nuts.
We're approaching year 8. We're old. Oh, my God.
If I didn't know about this, can I pretend not to be old?
You're not old. Yeah, you're fine.
You're fine and young, Sherlyn. But it's like, yeah, every time we talk about the history of games, I'm like, oh man, I was there for this. I remember this. That was too long ago. Do you think, Jess? I think Bungie fills a hole for Sony. I'm more wondering, you know, Sherlyn, I think you'd call yourself a casual gamer. So maybe, I don't know if like the intricacies of this are interesting to you, but would you be more interested in a game? Like, would you be more interested in buying a PlayStation if you could, you know, buy a cool game that's like a living experience rather than,
so
you know, just a single player title or something?
Fun fact, one of my friends used to work for a Bungie on Destiny. She wrote for Destiny. So that's for that reason I was always casually, more than casually interested in Destiny and Bungie. She left to join a different indie game developer now. So I'm like, you could have been owned by Sony, but no. I am indie, more curious. Indie. She's happier that way. But I'm very curious. So for me, after this news broke, I was like, oh, great. Like, it's big news, I thought, in the gaming industry. I have a question for you, Jess, but before I get to that, I was like looking at Reddit, and I think it was in Our Data is Beautiful and Our Gaming, someone posted this pie chart looking thing made up of logos of all the different brands in gaming and all different studios and who owns what. And you look at like Microsoft's slice of the pie, you've got T2's slice of the pie, you've got Tencent with the different things. Is this overall consolidation and like the continued acquisition of studios by these bigger conglomerate brands like a good thing just for consumers, or like, is it something to worry about?
Well, that's the question. So when the Activision Microsoft deal went live, I wrote not the news post about it. I wrote the follow up, the hot take. I put some context around it. And my conclusion was that this level of consolidation is bad for the industry. Just saying it's bad for developers and bad for consumers in terms of homogenization and in terms of just getting rid of this ability to cut deals that are good for the game, and instead they're going to be focused on huge platform holders and what's good for them. So I don't know. There's a whole world of, as along with this consolidation effort that's truly happening, truly ramping up right now, there's also this era of streaming that we're entering. That's what Microsoft is trying to build. That's what Sony is trying to get in on the ground floor of, because they need something. So there's a lot happening. There's a lot of change. The industry is going to be completely different. I want to talk to more developers about what they're feeling about these deals, how they're going to navigate these things. So that's actually, I'm working on a little bit of that right now. So hopefully we'll have a better answer in a week or so. But
introduce you to my friend.
Please. Yo, yes. Absolutely. Actually, yes. So yeah, it's hard to say, but it's definitely a new world for gaming.
It is. It's a little disappointing too, because I feel like Bungie was reveling in their freedom a little. Like once they got out of the Activision publishing deal too, it was like 2018, 2019, like they were purely on their own, doing their own destiny, like in control
were
of
they
their destiny.
In control? Yeah. Damn it. You made the joke before
and
I
now,
could.
Yep, too slow. But now they're back under the thumb of a big corporation. Is this good news, bad news for Destiny in general? Like, I wonder if like Sony was just like, hey, you have complete creative freedom. We just want to like be able to tap into you guys whenever possible. Is this a good thing for Bungie or a bad thing? Yeah, it's hard to tell.
You know, honestly, like, so I just threw out the line, like, go indie, stay indie. Yeah, I kind of stand by that. Yep. But I don't think that signing to a larger company with money and support, that doesn't make you a sellout. It doesn't mean that it's a terrible idea for every studio. Sometimes that's how you grow. Sometimes that's how you find new audiences. That's okay. In terms of Bungie being at Sony, so far, it seems from the early interviews coming out after this deal, it seems that Bungie is going to have complete creative freedom. They're going to keep building for cross-platform, you know, cross-platform experiences. They're not going to just stick with Sony consoles. They're positioning it as only a good thing for the studio. But Bungie has a history of signing deals and regretting it.
Yep.
Truly, they do. Like this is there have been cheers in the offices.
Yeah, they're very non-committal. Yeah. Yes.
Well, I think they sign a deal that sounds good and then, you know, you realize what it actually means. And hopefully they've done enough homework at this time that this deal is actually, you know, going to help them do whatever the hell they want to do. Because I do think there are some really talented people at Bungie. They've done some amazing things with Destiny. It was not a guaranteed hit. This studio could have been gone. The Halo studio could have been gone, you know? So
Destiny 1 was rough, like at the beginning. It took them a while to figure out like what they wanted to do. I feel like, Destiny, it didn't really click until Destiny 2. So that's a whole other thing for them.
I have a couple of questions from our live chat right now, Jess, that I think are directed to you. Bryant Mitchell asked, could that break up Bungie into smaller teams to work on more games? And then for both of you, Dev and Jess, there is a question about, could any of these big companies buy Nintendo?
No.
No, so no. Actually, Nintendo fight this tooth and nail.
One of our coworkers actually asked me that in Slack the other day. They were like, yo, like, is Nintendo going to get bought? And they were comparing Nintendo to Sega. And I was like, no, wrong comparison. Nintendo is huge. Nintendo is doing its own thing. Nintendo is pretty untouchable. Like, truly, I wouldn't worry about them. And what was the previous question?
Would Sony break up Bungie into smaller teams to work on different games? Mm.
No, not necessarily. They're actually hiring. They got a lot of money. They have a lot of support. They're hiring. So, yeah, sure, they're going to have some reorganization, I bet. I bet they are already working on games past Destiny. You know, like there's already stuff happening.
Roadmap,
they're clearly doing this. Yeah, so
like,
hopefully
for
this
the love
is
of God, Bungie, make a single-player game. Just
wouldn't that be
make
great?
A single-player game again. Let's go backwards a little.
Well, they're at Sony now. Why not? Maybe they will.
Let's
do it. Absolutely.
Let's do it. Got some questions too from our producer Ben, which I think is worth talking about here too. Like, is this consolidation a bad thing for developer labor unions? Because I know we've been following that, and like the state of unionization in the industry. Is this worse or better?
This is one of the reasons I think that consolidation is is not great in the long run. I think it will explode and we'll kind of go back to where we were again at some point. But so Activision Blizzard, there's a studio that works on Call of Duty.
Oh!
It's a Call of Duty studio. Call of Duty.
The Susu studio for Call of Duty.
So Raven Software. They are under Activision. They work on Call of Duty Warfare. Wow, I can't stop saying Call of Duty. They are trying to unionize, though. There are some QA testers at Raven trying to unionize. And they are actually, like, they have enough votes. They have a supermajority of votes. Activision has been getting in their way every step of this process. And Activision, just as they announced they have the votes to form a union, Activision failed to voluntarily recognize them, which means they have to go through the NLRB. And that can take years to get recognized this way. And Activision has split up the QA testers at Raven Software, like just days after this announcement. They're like, oh, just happen to be reorganizing now. And so that dilutes their power. And they're also calling for all of Raven Software to vote on the union, not just QA organizers. And they're also posting messages in Slack channels, in company Slack channels. The VP of QA at Raven posted a very anti-unionization message, just completely undermining any efforts there. They're clear, these large companies don't want unions. And organization is something that is a hot topic in gaming right now because there are no unions at major studios. There are a few indie studios that are getting into unionization and giving their employees a measure of control over the work-life balance they have, over what their skills are worth, all this stuff. But this doesn't exist in the large-scale gaming industry. So it's a big deal, and Activision is doing everything it can to stop it. And I guess that includes Microsoft as well now too. So,
yeah. Any further? Depressing. So depressing. Like, you were bringing up the idea, like, would anybody buy Nintendo? I feel like if that ever happened, like, if Nintendo reached a point where they were being bought by a big company, or like they were desperate enough to be bought, I kind of feel like video games would be over.
Yep.
Right. Like this video game industry just kind of gone. That would be another like big, like the big death of video games, like in the early 80s, right? So I hope we never get to that point, folks. Like anybody positing about Nintendo being bought or sold or whatever, like that would be bad news. I think that would have ripple effects throughout the entire industry. So I hope we never get to see that. But hey, we've got some other studios floating around, Jess. So like people have been talking about like, okay, so what I'm sure Sega's out there like, hey, Microsoft, you'll spend $69 billion to buy Activision. We're here. We're a bargain. We have all these properties. Like, would you think that would be a better fit for Sony or Microsoft? Like, are there other studios you think these companies would be more into? Capcom is like another one people have been talking about for a while.
That would be amazing. That makes sense at Sony. I'm just thinking, like, will Nintendo go on a buying spree? I haven't really thought about
it. I think that would be the cool surprise,
Right, maybe that's where Sega ends up.
Nintendo, you know, like, buys Sega.
Nintendo buys Sega. Right, there you go. That makes a lot of sense. Oh my gosh.
That would
Even
make sense.
I know that.
That would make so much sense. Yeah, you do, right? See, there you go. Okay, we made this deal. Like, we better get, like, commission on this deal.
Yeah, Sega, make that deal. I'm gonna call you. In terms of like characters and like platformers and stuff that would like work together, like you give us like a true Sonic Mario game, like that would be. What if the next Sonic adventure was a Mario adventure? You know, a Sonic and Mario adventure. Sonic riding Yoshi.
I think
dogs and cats living together.
I would actually hate that, but it makes sense for them.
I think one of our producers
Sonic making Yoshi go Sonic. Go ahead.
Threw up the name Kojita Studios. Is that something you're familiar with?
Kojita? Or Kojima.
Are you talking Kojima?
Seeing Kojita. Okay.
Kojima.
So Julio meant Kojima. Okay.
Well, I mean, he has a pretty good relationship with Sony.
I think Sony would be like, yeah, dude, like whatever it takes.
Did
people buy Death Stranding? That was a success.
Yeah, they just released
it's not a great game.
It's a fine game. It's just a bad movie, Kojima. Make a game, please.
To me, it's like overall bad experience. But yeah. It's
I liked
definitely
it.
More of a movie.
That's fine. Yeah.
We solved the Nintendo Sega problem. I kept wondering, like, would Microsoft ended up buying Sega, which would be this weird full circle thing because Microsoft made the operating system for Dreamcast. They made Windows CE, which powered Sega's last console. Windows CE arguably helped kill the Dreamcast because it was so hackable. So people cracked that OS pretty quickly and were like copying games and like, you know, doing easy imports and stuff. Then, like, didn't the head of Sega of America went over to Microsoft, basically? A lot of people have argued the Xbox 360 is basically the Dreamcast 2. Like, it seems like after a certain point, helping to kill Sega, Microsoft should just be like, hey, here's a bone.
That'd be funny.
We'll buy your IP.
Yeah. No, that would be funny.
Or something. Yeah.
No, and it's funny, like, Mike Ibarra, if we're going to go to, like, cross-contamination, Mike Ibarra used to be at Microsoft, went to Activision, now he's back at Microsoft. It's like, you can't run away from these big companies, and that's going to be the thread that, like, you know, in the next decade of gaming, I feel like, is going to be cross-contamination.
I hear you. All right. Thank you so much, Jess. Where can people find you on the internet these days?
I'm on Twitter, Jess Condit. Yeah. And then on Instagram, at Jess L. Condit.
So let's move on to our other big story this week, and that is the continued trouble that Spotify is facing with Joe Rogan. Yeah. Although it is more and more confusing. So last week we talked about the fact that Neil Young, the famed rock and roller folk singer, I don't know where you'd classify him, but I love his music. But Neil Young said that, Spotify, it's really either me or Joe Rogan. And then Neil Young took his music off of Spotify. And what has followed since then is that a bunch of other artists have basically done what Neil Young did. So that includes Joni Mitchell, who's kind of contemporary to him, NDRE, who is more of a 90s artist, David Crosby, Graham Nash, Stephen Stills, a bunch of other artists, typically like folks who were big in the 70s and 80s. And to be clear, a lot of folks who probably made their money already, you know, in the music industry. So they have less to lose by leaving streaming. But a lot of those folks are stepping away from Spotify. People are talking more about Spotify's, like, their responsibility for hosting somebody like Joe Rogan. And the whole reason for this is that Neil Young specifically was against Joe Rogan's sort of like anti-vax and COVID misinformation that has been a big part of his show forever. Even since before Spotify ended up paying Joe Rogan $100 million for exclusive rights to that show, Spotify didn't like buy the show outright. You know, they don't own it, but they own publication rights to it exclusively. So it is kind of a sticky situation there. But yeah, there is just so much going on. Podcasts have also announced that they're taking this seriously. Brené Brown, who hosts a couple of popular shows, which she was essentially acquired by Spotify, she says that she won't be producing any new episodes for the time being. The Spotify-owned podcast, Science Versus, says that they're going to spend their next series of episodes debunking all of Joe Rogan's anti-science claims. So there's a lot of pushback here, some interesting pushback too from people who Spotify owns. Sherlyn, like, what are you hearing all of this? What are you thinking? Does it make you think differently about Spotify as a platform?
And, I mean,
you know, about what they're doing?
Well, So I just kind of was like gearing up to say that Spotify has also responded by, I'm sure we're getting to that. But I mean, early on when it was just Neil Young, I was just like, I mean, sure. I don't, since Neil Young's not a staple in my playlist, you know?
Exactly. I don't think Spotify will drop Joe Rogan for Neil Young.
Right.
That was never the idea. Yeah.
And like I already had my personal issues with Spotify. The app in some cases just really is awful, even though Spotify as an app has just a lot more features and options, I guess, compared to other music apps, right? Music streaming apps. But I've already been frustrated enough by Spotify's connect feature because it doesn't really work very well with my home speakers. But anyway, I've already,
it sounds like you need a better router, Sherlyn.
I've been looking for an excuse to ditch Spotify, and this might very well be it. I also am somewhat familiar with the Joe Rogan podcast, even if I haven't listened to it ever. I know people who have, and I know people who like just listen to it for the information, or who listen to it because there are certain episodes that don't, you know, come off as very, very misleading or entirely, you know, spreading misinformation. There are episodes that are interviews with prominent scientists, or like I was speaking to my my chiropractor, mm-hmm. who I'm about to out as a Joe Rogan listener.
Not as if they're in the middle of like cracking your spine. Yeah, you don't want to hear. Yeah,
exactly.
You don't want to hear that.
In the middle of like fixing. But then they listen to the Joe Rogan podcast and they're like, yeah, well, they, you know, most recently Joe Rogan apparently had a PhD person on there talking about, God, I even forgot. I think I must have tuned out what they were saying.
I think the appeal here too is that Joe Rogan is very good at getting, like, he's basically made himself a podcast empire. So he gets big guests, he gets people to come on, people that, hey, I want to hear what those people have to say. But he also gets a lot of people who are noted conspiracy theorists, right, or people who are like the whole Jordan Peterson thing. People who are, just not, the things they're saying are not necessarily true. And especially as we're in the middle of a pandemic, it seems somewhat irresponsible to platform people in general. Joe Rogan has been like very much on the anti-vax side of things, and there have been studies showing like his listeners, not surprisingly, are often against vaccines as well. And that to me seems like a big public danger in the middle of a pandemic.
What I was going to say is that, like, it's fine to sort of like interview controversial figures. It's fine as long as you're like, as long as when they're saying things that are factually wrong, you have a responsibility to your listener to point that out. I mean, the whole thing, like when I got into radio a long, long, long time ago, my like student radio director was just like, you can't, you have all these regulations because of the FCC, and also just you can't spread mistruths. Like, it's a whole thing, but you know, there's a responsibility.
That hasn't stopped certain TV networks and stuff, too. And right-wing radio is still a big thing. But I don't want to sound like I'm picking on Joe Rogan fans here, too. Like, it's, I think back in the day, when he first got started, and for the first couple of years, he seemed like, hey, like, this was a guy a lot of people like listening to. And personally, I think it really comes down to men, dudes, do not have enough friends to talk to. I think that's a lot of it. Like, we've talked about parasocial relationships here on podcasts, and we, you know, hey, as we're doing the show, we have regular listeners, we have people who follow what we're saying, like, you follow the drama of it. And with a podcast especially, like, I've done this, a lot of my favorite podcasts are people I followed for over a decade. I like listening to them. They feel like friends when I hear, you know, them talking, and often they're talking about things that I don't have time for in my daily life. For me, it's simpler things like video games or something, or like scientific information. But hearing them talk about it kind of gives me a certain amount of like comfort. Like, oh, my friends say this. That's interesting. That's kind of broadening my horizons. And Joe Rogan's very much a guy who just says, like, and he said this in his statement about what's going on. It's like, I'm just asking questions, man. Just asking questions about what's happening. To make it clear, Spotify kind of addressed what people were saying with, I think, the worst, kind of the worst response is that they would put a disclaimer in front of Joe Rogan's shows, which to me seems like a little laughable, because the things people are accusing him of are vaccine misinformation, COVID-19 misinformation, which have a big public health, you know, risk there. That is the strategy social networks took. You know, like when we've talked about Twitter and Facebook and how they handle misinformation, YouTube just last week completely banned Dan Bongino, however you pronounce his last name, but noted like right-wing conspiracy theorist for COVID-19 misinformation. So other platforms where people are producing stuff for them have taken, you know, both the warning labels and the banning action. The Joe Rogan Spotify thing is kind of interesting, because Spotify does not own the Joe Rogan podcast, but Spotify owns the exclusive rights to publish the Rogan podcast. So in a sense, like, they are his publisher.
Right.
They can direct certain things, right?
In a way that limits it, right? Like, that kind of, like, thankfully it's not being carried on, like, at least this particular podcast of his, not being carried on the other platforms because it's exclusive. But
it's exclusive,
It's got a huge reach.
That's the entire thing, right? Spotify spent $100 million to get his show. That's one show. They did this for subscriber numbers, right? People, if you want to listen to Joe Rogan, you have to subscribe to Spotify. That is the main growth, like, module for pretty much every, you know, streaming company or whatever, like they will do whatever it takes to grow. There is a really good piece by Elizabeth Spears I just want to shout out over at Medium called Why Can't Spotify Edit Joe Rogan? And I think it's worth reading because they are essentially his publisher, you know, and if you're an opinion writer like she is, she writes for other publications. New York Times will not just let you spout lies, even if it's the opinion pages, right? They can let you be a little provocative, but you can't just outright lie. They have the power to like edit your writing, kind of like say you can't say certain things like that. This isn't censorship. This is like what a publisher does. You know, when I write stuff for Engadget, if my editor is like, no, I don't think that's necessarily true, I work with my editor because that's my job. And essentially, Rogan is working for Spotify. You know, it is a weird, sticky situation. What do you think, Sherlyn, about how they've handled this and kind of where this is going? Does this make you think differently about Spotify in general?
I would be interested to see what else they say after this, if this is the end of their so-called measures, because from what I've seen in the news so far, it seems like Spotify's stock is dropping with everything that's happening, which is apparently you hurt any sort of number financially, and big companies, that's when they take notice, right? So now they're probably going to think, well, we got to find a better way to, you know, make people happy is a bad way to say it, but it is if you're talking about just share prices. That's the problem is that they haven't thought about it as an issue beyond just making people happy. They're just like, well, these people aren't pleased with this podcast. We're going to slap a warning label on it. And
yeah,
this
here's
shut
a
them
warning
up.
Label.
Right. And instead of thinking really cogently about what the problem actually is, because then that's where you start to come up with guidelines and policies across the entire platform, not just this one podcast. It also, to be clear, this should be something that Spotify is thinking, as you said, they're the publisher. It should be thinking about this as a platform-wide issue rather than a one particular podcast issue. This warning label should be slapped on any podcast that's spreading misinformation, but I don't
it should.
Know that.
It should, but also you should probably be going further. And like, what did Spotify start as, right? Like, let's go back to the beginning. Spotify, before Spotify, the idea of like just streaming all of your music, you know, people use YouTube a lot to like just play music videos in the background or something. But the idea of having an app that would just pull pretty much any song from anywhere in the cloud, it was founded in Europe. It got big there too. I remember when like a lot of my European friends were like, oh, this cool thing, Spotify, you Americans don't have this. You have to buy stuff on iTunes. And when Spotify launched here, it was super successful. And then it like, to the point where there are other streaming offerings, like there's Apple Music, there's Amazon Prime Music. They're not as good. They're not like, and there's arguments you can make about Apple Music too. Like, I think Apple Music as an experience can be pretty great. Tech-wise, Apple Music, Tidal, even Amazon Prime offer higher quality and higher bit rates and stuff. So like for the audiophiles and the nerds, those services have better offerings too. There have been like rumors about Spotify going hi-fi and they haven't fully announced any of that yet. They've basically like helped invent this market. They kind of dominate it. Some would argue like they have a monopoly over it too, because like every artist wants to be on Spotify. But this is the first time we're seeing people just say, hey, we don't want to be associated with you if you can't do anything to maintain your platform. So this seems like something every platform holder has to deal with, right? If you have something on your platform, if you're allowing it, especially if you're paying somebody for it, you have a responsibility there, right?
Yeah. And you're right that it goes beyond just slapping a label on it, because the thing about the label is what it does is it maybe informs the people who weren't informed or who were completely out of the loop on all of this, or who have like no, like have never heard the name. Let's say for in this case, the example is Joe Rogan. They've never heard about it before. They're going to see that and maybe get an inkling that like, okay, I might have to take what is being said here with a grain of salt, but it will do nothing for, and I argue that we can do nothing for the people who are just have decided to stick to their guns. We're going to support this podcast no matter what. I don't care what you're saying, etc. There's no really changing the points of views of those people, because we've seen in the last, I want to say 6 years or 5 years, that like people are going to believe what they want to believe, and there no amount of fact checking is going to tell you otherwise. So I feel like it's a difficult position, not just for, again, Spotify, but all platform, like all podcast platforms.
For sure. all these platforms, any media platform, for the past decade, all they've been concerned with was just growing, right? You got to beat the competition. You got to get the people that will get eyeballs and get more subscribers. And now all of a sudden, it's like the crashing responsibility of, oh, no, you built this thing. Now you're responsible for this ship of information. If it's good or bad, it has your name on it. It's your platform. Now you have to deal with it. And I think a lot of companies still don't know how to reckon with that. I want to just read something quickly. Wendy Zuckerman, the host of Science Versus, wrote to the CEO of Spotify. So in her letter, she says, as Science Versus was show in an upcoming episode during Rogan's interview with Dr. Robert Malone, information about the vaccines is repeatedly taken out of context. There's plenty of scientific evidence that contradicts some of the claims in the interview, but it's nowhere to be found in the episode. Rogan's show leaves the audience with a skewed and inaccurate view of the COVID-19 vaccines, and Spotify has done little to address this. I think that's the big crux of it there. A lot of people, like, hey, I see people in the chat talking about the marketplace of ideas or something. The marketplace of ideas is people saying, hey, I don't like this, and I'm going to take my stuff and go elsewhere. It's not, Spotify has basically done no censorship here. It is just people reacting to not wanting to be associated with that. So yeah, it's a sticky situation. Hopefully we'll hear more about it in the next few weeks. Sherlyn, like, any other thoughts on this?
A few things. Yeah, I mean, like, ideas aren't facts. So there's that. Also, the other thing is, like,
but the marketplace of ideas.
At the same time,
they just want to be debated.
I know. Yeah. At the same time, there, you know, much as I like, is anyone really truly gonna quit Spotify over this? I think a lot of people have, yes, but
some people have, yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
And for me, it's more like, A, what else is out there? We just talked about Apple Music, YouTube Music, Prime Music. But B, it's also like, like you said, it's not censorship, it's a publishing platform. So I have the option of just never listening to this particular show, which I have done for the last however many years it's been on, and I will continue to do. So I don't know. It's like, we'll see what Spotify says. I guess for now, I guess out of convenience, I'm going to hold on for a little bit more to see how Spotify responds. But if Spotify doesn't do a good job, I guess it might be time to think about giving my money to someone else.
Yeah. Look at your other options, and maybe we will talk about this. Like, what should your next streaming service be? Or just, hey, let's line up everybody here. Because I think a lot of people subscribe to Spotify by default. Maybe they don't know the offerings there. If you have AirPods or the fancy Apple headphones.
Oh, AirPod Max, yeah.
AirPods Max, yeah. Which nobody owns. Those things don't exist, right? Like, I never hear about them. But if you have AirPods or the new Beats Pro and whatever, you can use Apple's spatial reality music as well. So, like, Dolby Digital stuff. You get some really good surround sound. So that is, that's an option. Tidal has been launched as, like, an artist-focused service. So the idea is that they give more money back to artists, and I think some data we've seen has shown that. They also offer higher quality music. Also, Amazon Prime does that too, and Apple does that. So they all offer lossless quality music. Some of them even offer, like, high res, like 48 kilohertz, much, much higher bit rates and higher levels of quality than people would get over Bluetooth. But they all offer those things too. Spotify doesn't. Spotify has just been kind of like, there from the beginning. So maybe we'll dive into that. Let us know what your ideal, your favorite music streaming service is now too. Maybe you just built a Plex box and just put all those MP3s somewhere and you don't have to deal with any of this mess. Tell us what you prefer. podcast@engadget.com. Let's move on to some other news, and I'm going to throw this one to you, Sherlyn, because I feel like you probably have feelings about this. You've played Wordle more than I have at this point.
So this week, the devastating news, I don't know, I'm overselling this. To me, it was just not great news, but the New York Times announced it's bought Wordle, the game that, hey, if you're not playing, don't worry about it. It's a word game based on the game creator's last name. And it's basically a combination of his last name and the word. So it's a fun little game. A lot of us have been playing it. If you've seen the little green and yellow and gray boxes pop up on your social media timelines, that's the game we're referring to. And the New York Times has bought it. And the New York Times has said, I mean, that game, Wordle as a game, has a new word every day. You can't play more than once a day. So New York Times has sort of said it will continue this model for now. It won't be putting it behind a paywall. It won't be, forcing, I don't know, archives of the game to go live somewhere for a fee. If they do, maybe that's the one thing that might be a silver lining out of all this, because for now, Wordle, the game, is a once a day, no way, a free to play, and there's no way to kind of like access the archives type of game. But that,
and it's just a website.
Yes,
too,
it's
which
just
I think
a website.
Really,
it's so light. It's really well written as a front end is great because there's a keyboard on the screen and it's like it will highlight the hints and tell you what letters
it tells you,
or available.
It gives you the rules like straight up. And then within a couple games, you like learn it, right?
Yeah. So it's a straightforward little thing. Go ahead.
How deep are you in your Wordle fandom at this point?
I think my streak is something like 30. Like I have never lost a Wordle, so I've guessed all of them within six tries so far. My worst score was in six tries. I got the one that started with PRO. I think the word was proxy, and I guessed prods, prong, probes. Like I just guessed all kinds of PRO words before I got to proxy, because of course X and Y are two of the least common letters in the alphabet, and I didn't guess it. Anyway, I'm pretty deep in. How about you, Devendra?
I'm not. And I've learned that I am very bad at word games. So there is something about this and crosswords in general, too, where my brain is just very bad at processing that sort of pattern recognition. So, you know, I've played every couple of days. I try to play a Wordle. I'm like, I literally don't want to spend the time engaging on this, mainly because I have so much other stuff I have to do as well. So I'd never have the time to sit down and focus on it. But yeah, it's not fun for me. I know people love word games. So yeah, more power to you. I think what's really interesting here is that this is like a pure organic success story here too, right? The creative Wordle, Josh Wordle, made this thing. He himself was inspired by some of the New York Times own little word games.
Right.
So he made this thing, which now has 10...
Or is
Spelling Bee. And Spelling Bee is good. Yeah. I like Spelling Bee. But now it has tens of millions of users, and he's able to sell this cute little web app for, the time says, in the low seven figures. So, yeah,
that's a lot of money for a little game that he made for his partner.
I
do want to say that, like, you brought up the Times' other word games. This is very much in the style of the Times' model, which is, again, one game a day. You get access to a free puzzle, like the crossword mini or the spelling bee of the day. So the way I see it is I think the New York Times is going to sort of do the same sort of approach to this, to Wordle, maybe incorporate it into the New York Times crossword app. I hope it still remains as a website because, you know, that way no one has to install a whole other app to play it. Everyone can play it and it's fun. The other thing that's interesting out of all of this is all the Wordle clones that have come up, Devendra. Have you heard of them?
I mean, I've heard of some of them.
What's
like
your favorite?
I think Gary Witta, the writer and former like game journalist, I think he created Loodle, which is the one that's just about like sex words.
Nice.
Just like really lewd words and helping you learn new terms. And I hear people are learning all sorts of things about it. But hey, those remixes are fun.
Yes.
The things that aren't fun are the people that just like made apps that copied Wordle and started selling them and made money.
Okay, so here's a personal story for y'all. So my cousin saw all my I've refrained from posting my Wordle scores because I don't want to show off how good I am. No, I'm kidding.
That is the entire point of this game is to show everybody like what you've done
or how bad if you didn't get
rarely,
it.
Rarely do people post those.
I only show my 2 of 6, but every time I have a 2 out of 6, I post it because I'm like so shocked at myself. So my cousin has seen it and he like reached out to me the other day and he was like, okay, fine, you've got me converted. And he showed me a screenshot of him playing faux Wordle, a version of Wordle. I was like, bro, you got the wrong one. I was like, no, bro, like that's a clone. Don't support them.
I've heard this from a lot of people. Like they end up playing the wrong game too, because how do you start playing Wordle? You have to like go to Google and type Wordle and hope you spell it correctly and hope you hit the right thing. Like it is very unintuitive. It never even got like a domain.
No, it's just powerlanguage.co.uk. That's it.
Some random domain. Yeah. Amazing.
But so that's sad. And I guess like I don't know if it'll be better if the New York Times just rebrands it for itself. I don't think so. But yeah, no, the Wordle app clones are bad. The variants of it, those are interesting. Yesterday, in case you were unaware, apparently a version called Taylordle dropped. It's all Taylor Swift. Swifties who Wordle. And yeah, it's a Taylor Swift version. It's Wordle Taylor Swift version, in case you get the joke. But if you don't, it's okay. It's not a good joke. But yeah, I love this whole development. I also love that all the different clones are also based on this guy's last name. So like he's just kind of famous now because they all based it on the name, the original name, which was all based on his last name to begin with. So hey, good for this. This is like a charming little story of a person that didn't set out to like win hearts or to influence people. He just sought to make a nice game and something good just spoke for itself.
People like games. Yeah. There's like a cute little like viral aspect to this. I think the dark side of this is just that the New York Times has way too much money and they can just like, they are now like the dark lord of media and just like fun thing. Like they're scooping up everything
also,
at this point. So everything, yeah.
The fact that they were able to spend like a 7-figure sum on this game and then, you know, not
exactly.
give the people that the union were asking for like basic raises. It was just like kind of appalling. I've mm-hmm. been in companies.
The way they've treated
like
the
that.
Wire Cutter yeah. Union oh, yeah. and the New York Times Tech Workers Union. Like, those are two separate things. Right. And both times, the company has not been great.
It's like, pay the people that work for you. I mean, sure, buy this thing. It's just a lot of focus on return on investment and very little on the human investment and human valuing your human resources. So, oh, yeah. Well.
Talking about corporate investments and whatnot, you wanted to quickly talk about some things from Alphabet and Apple, Shirley?
Yes. So really quickly, these last 2 weeks have also been heavy earnings season for companies in tech. And if you watch your own portfolio like I do sometimes, it has been a very depressing few weeks. But big companies have had big results. For example, Apple broke all kinds of records. It broke its revenue record. It broke its iPhone, Mac, and wearables records, revenue records, which means, and despite global supply constraints. So good job, Apple, I guess, for managing your supply. I was more interested to see that Alphabet's earnings, it had managed to sell more Pixels than ever before. Pixels just had the best quarter ever. Mm-hmm. Good for them because the Pixel 6...
Well, they're getting cheaper, right? They're cheaper, they're better, they're more capable. Like
They've always been sort of around the same price, I want to say, but they're finally like good. The Pixel 6, we all really liked it. It's not boring like the Pixel 5 or problematic like the Pixel 4. It's just...
Well, it is. It sounds like it's plenty problematic. There
it
have been
still,
some software
it has its
like,
issues.
Updates.
Yes. I mean a Pixel 6 Pro right now, and like every day it's just like, would you stop gaslighting me sometimes?
Would you stop it's, having issues? Yeah.
Yes.
I was on Twitter a couple weeks ago, and people were talking about like their issues with Pixel 6. And it's a shame because that seemed like the phone that should have been like, hey, we've made an iPhone level perfect marriage between Google software and Google hardware and all this beautiful stuff. And no,
yeah,
it turns out.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
So, but good job. And I guess congratulations. I also want to say, I believe the A series contributes to this number. So the Pixel 4a, the 5a, those phones contribute to this number as well. And I'm not surprised, right? Those are like some of the best mid-range or lower cost phones out there. And Google has finally found its niche. That was kind of all I wanted to say about earnings season. And that I hope my investment portfolio, which, by the way, disclaimer, I only trade in funds because it's kind of unethical for me to buy individual stocks. So there you go. But anyway.
There's nothing stopping journalists from doing that, apparently, too. So as I've learned. So, yeah.
Do it. If you do it, disclaim it. That's all I'm saying. Just disclaim it. And
it's a mess.
Don't be unethical.
It's a real mess.
Yeah. Lord.
I think the thing with Pixel, too, is like at this point, people are like general consumers associate Pixel with Google. So your choice to which phone do you buy really comes down to, do I buy the Samsung? Do I buy the Google? Right. Everything else, all the other Android phones kind of don't matter anymore unless you're a super geek.
Right. Yeah. The super like specs of
they'll go
people,
OnePlus, they'll go
exactly.
whatever.
Exactly. We'll look at OnePlus as an option. And also in Asia and in non-American countries, then there's a lot more options. There's people who like, I see a lot of people buying Xiaomi or Oppo phones as well. It's just so happens that in the US, there's really Samsung, Google, and maybe OnePlus, and that's pretty much it.
Happy for Google, I guess. Like, I was there following the Nexus phones. I was there following, like, all these, like, little, the homegrown hardware that Google tried to do. I still have a Nexus 4 somewhere with the glass back and whatnot. So, hey, they've tried for so long. It's been over 10 years. I'm glad they found some sort of success here. And we'll keep an eye on it. Sherlyn, like, what is new in Pixeldom? Like, what are you looking forward to this year?
The rumored Pixel Watch, I'm pretty sure it's coming out this year.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. I'm almost 100% sure. But I wouldn't bet copious amounts of money on it. But yeah, no, that's what I'm looking forward to seeing this year. Even though I don't actually have any high hopes for it, I still expect the first gen Pixel Watch to kind of be a mess because I, A, temper my expectations, and B, like, track record's not great for Google or any
Android
company.
Smartwatches.
Yeah, exactly. For this industry in general. But that's what I'm looking forward to because I don't know what to expect with the phones anymore. I feel like they did a lot with the Pixel 6. I feel like they should really focus on smoothing that out and making that a more stable device and software for everyone. It's too early to say. I don't know. I don't want to start thinking about October right now.
Don't think about October. I do wonder, like, Google's such a big company. Like, why do you have these software issues? Like, what is the deal here? Like, you guys should be ironing this out. And every time these sorts of things happen, I remember, like, how bad Google is at consumer products. So I have a Nest device right now that just always loses its wireless. Always. I don't know why. There's no fixes for it. The Google Home app is a joke.
Well, I don't mind.
The Google Home app is one of the worst design things I've ever encountered. So it's those things that make me just, like, really shout. Yeah.
I get that. I mean, I have Nest speakers that are just awful at staying synced to each other or my Wi-Fi, apparently. Yep. And then also there's, like, the... I don't hate the Home app. I actually think it's fine. Maybe because I've just been so used to it, right? But
you're used to the pain. But yeah, the changing your thermostat and stuff. There are certain things where even on iOS, it's like, oh, this is a button.
Right.
This doesn't look like a button. This looks like a line of text that you made. Those things.
I'm so really glad to see David Herrera in our live chat is agreeing with us that their Nest device always loses their wireless connection. Now, I don't know exactly which device you're talking about, David, but for me, it's the Nest audio speakers. And I flagged this issue to Google multiple times. And they're like, they troubleshoot. They went to the extent of troubleshooting a lot. And they still were like, at the end of the day, they were like, oh, yeah, it sounds like you have a Wi-Fi issue on your end, which you did just say to me, like, I need a new router, Dev. But I'm also
you probably need a router, but still.
Yeah, exactly. Still. I'm like, no, but what if, like, Alexa can,
if
my Echo can stay connected. Oh, baby, don't respond.
It's okay. It's okay. Just say cancel.
Cancel.
But it's the same thing with my Nest thermostat. Like, I have two in my house for upstairs and downstairs. Usually at one point either day, at one point of the day, one of them will lose wireless. My parents also bought two for their home. Almost always lost wireless. It's not just you, but it's like something weird because then I did an AT&T update and they updated my, like, gigabit gateway, and that new router is more stable with the Nest. But clearly it's the way the Nest, like, works with some hardware, and Google hasn't figured this stuff out. Anyway, we will follow along with all this. And I think Google's continued, like, inability to create, like, a seamless consumer experience, I think, is hilarious. So it's just like a comedy of errors.
I'm going to try to figure out what's going on. We'll keep an eye on all this. I'm going to try to figure out what's wrong. We'll talk.
What's wrong?
What's wrong with fam? Google? Why can't you get what's your act up, together? Fam? Let me talk to you about therapy right now. Let's have some therapy.
Yeah, just sit down. Flip a chair around and, you know, sit on it. Like, let's jam. Let's jam about consumer
new
products.
Podcast,
let's move on to what we're working on. The HP Spectre X360 16. This is the bigger, newer HP Spectre. That is their, like, premium line. It's very pretty. It's an X360, so that means it's a convertible. You can flip the screen all the way around. I am reviewing that right now, and review should be up. I'm going to be out next week, but the review should be up, like, right after that. It's cool. I like HP premium laptops. I think we have some issues with their, like, basic stuff, but their premium stuff, the keyboard feels great, the trackpad is great, and I love, like, they just are very good at making an edge-to-edge screen now, so this is a really nice device.
Oh, yeah.
I just wish Yeah, they couldn't send us the 12th gen Intel chips to review, so I know that's going to be shipping this year on some of these models. I just wish we could have, you know, actually seen that. But yeah, I wish you could play with this one, Sherlock.
I love HP's Spectre and Spectre X360 line. I just question for you, Devendra, is it rare to get a 16-inch convertible that flips all the way around?
I think that's one reason why I picked this one up is because, so instead of having a 50-inch laptop, they have like shaved the bezels down. They've been able to cram in bigger displays. So I think this takes the place of a 50-inch convertible. And as a tablet, it is definitely way too big. You know, I would probably never do that. But, you know, to have a screen that you can flip around and like in bed, just sit and watch video with it, like either in tent formation or like you flip it around and like put the keyboard on the bottom and then have the screen facing you, like that's kind of nice. And it's a nice big screen. So it's like you're sitting in bed with like, you know, almost like a large TV in front of your face. That's kind of nice. And it's a beautiful screen too. So it is a weird thing to have such a big convertible.
Right. I know. It's kind of, it's just a strange concept to me. But anyhow, while you're out next week, I will be taking over the podcast. I will run this show. No, I don't know what voice that was, my new Marvel villain voice. But I will be working on Samsung, already doing a lot of prep. I'm also working on that mysterious thing that I talked about that some people asked me about privately afterwards. I promise you guys, it will be worth the wait. It is a ride. It is a whole thing. And then, yeah, next week is Samsung. We will be having a live stream of Samsung's event here on the Engadget YouTube channel. If you're just listening to the podcast, mark your calendars for Wednesday, February 9th at about 9:30 or 9:40 a.m. Eastern is when we'll go live on the Engadget YouTube channel. We'll stick around, chit chat like we do on the morning broadcast for the podcast. And then, yeah, Thursday, I'll also be here with a guest co-host. We're going to keep it a secret mystery for now. Will we see the return of some beloved Engadget members? We don't know.
It's actually a small cast, so you know, you could take a pretty wild guess.
It may or may not be from Engadget. I don't know. We'll see. Maybe like Jonathan Anderson in our live chat says, I'm just going to do all the different voices on my solo run as the Engadget podcast host next week. Who knows? Maybe I'll have a mental breakdown. You'll see. But that's what I'm working on.
Okay, let's move on to our pop culture picks of the week. And Sherlyn, you always have a surprise for us. So what do you have to talk about?
I'm pretty sure you've heard of this one and you've even probably watched it and loved it. This is Amazon Prime Video's Electric Dreams. Do you like it? Have you seen it?
I have not seen this one, honestly, because I have not heard good things about it.
Really?
Yeah, tell me.
All right, it a lot. It's basically a different version of Black Mirror. It's an anthology. It's, you know, standalone episodes, each telling a story adapted from one of Philip K. Dick's short stories. A whole bunch of them. And they're all produced nicely, well-acted. There's some huge names in the series. You've got Bryan Cranston. You've got Terrence Howard. What was his? Oh, crap. I keep forgetting this guy's name. Steve Buscemi. Thank you. In my head.
Steve Buscemi. Yeah.
I can't remember offhand who else. Oh, what's his name? Stark. Rob Stark. Richard Madden is also in it. I almost went Rob Stark. And then his Eternals name, which I also can't remember right now. Just lots of great talent involved in this. And I don't know, the Rotten Tomatoes rating is like 75-76%, so it's actually pretty good for something like that. And yeah, it gives me Black Mirror vibes. It gives me great science fiction vibes. I love it. And I actually have been rationing episodes to watch because of how much I like it. Like, I know that every episode is actually great. I've seen 8 out of 10 right now. 8 out of 10 episodes now. I've been saving the last two to just kind of, you know, have a slow burn weekend to watch. And I enjoy it. It's good sci-fi.
Cool. I'm glad you're digging it. I want to shout out a couple of things too. First is The After Party, which is the new Apple TV Plus show that is a ton of fun. I love this show so much. It is created by Christopher Miller, half of the group, half of the like directing duo, Lord and Miller. They did the 21 Jump Street reboot, which I think is an incredible comedy. They did the Lego Movie. They like anything these guys touch is basically genius because they're just some of the funniest and like smartest, most creative people around. They're also like, you know, they produced Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse as well. Like, that, you know, Mitchell's and the Machines, also producers there. This is a murder mystery show That is just, it is basically like a comedy. Like, it is stars Tiffany Haddish as a detective who stumbles into this party where a famous, I don't know, pop star played by Dave Franco, his name is Xavier, has died. And all the people at the party are suspects. So it's like a good little Clue-like murder mystery. But the really fun part is that every episode or everybody's story takes the form of a different movie genre. Because Tiffany Haddish's character is like, you got to tell me your mind movie, you know, about your perspective. Nice. It's a little Rashomon. But that part of it is really fun. The cast is incredible. Includes like Sam Richardson, Ben Schwartz, Alana Glazer, other people I love. Ike Barinholtz, Jamie Demetrio, you know, who is somebody, he's from that HBO show Staff Let's Flats, which is this like cute, quirky, like weird UK show. But there's just like, it's a good amount of talent here. John Early from Search Party, which just wrapped up. That's another show, by the way. If you like Search Party, check out the After Party. And at some point I'll talk about like the wild ass season, the final season of Search Party. I think you'd enjoy that, Sherlyn. Okay. Yeah, I'll talk about that. But I think the After Party is a lot of fun. It's really, really funny. Love the cast and love this like concept of going over different genres. You know, they do it in a really fun and interesting way. So check it out if you have Apple TV Plus. Also, just want to shout out, warn you not to watch the movie Moonfall, which is one of the dumbest things I've ever seen in my life. Just pure stupidity. But hey. You know, I do miss the days when we had bad movies that we could watch with friends, you know, get some drinks, watch a really terrible movie, like a B movie with people, and just like really enjoy that on that level.
Yeah.
You know, Moonfall may be worth it, but it's a movie about the moon falling to Earth,
people. I'm like there.
The moon
I'm there.
Is falling.
Give me an apocalypse
moon
anytime.
Fall.
Yeah.
Moonfall. The moon fall, okay? It is hilarious. And it's also like, it is like a pastiche of every Roland Emmerich movie. So there's a lot of Independence Day in here. There's a lot of Day After Tomorrow. There's a lot of like large scale destruction. Yeah.
Are they deliberately trying to be bad in the vein of Don't Look Up or like Kristen?
I don't think Don't Look Up was trying to be bad. Like Don't Look Up was trying to go for a specific vibe. Right. But yeah, this is another like, hey, the world is ending. What do we do about it? But this, honestly, this is the kind of movie that Don't Look Up was also like, parodying, like Don't Look Up was making fun of movies like this. Yeah. So
have you seen
it? Is
I loved it.
I've seen Don't Look Up. I thought we talked about it here, but yeah, it's fine. It's perfectly
funny,
fine.
Yeah.
There's a lot of like, I wish it was funnier. I wish it was sharper. But I think the ending hits pretty hard, especially right now. But man, this movie is just like, you put all of Roland Emmerich's movies, Independence Day, Day After Tomorrow, 2012.
Oh, all my favorite bad movies. I'm gonna watch
all your favorite
this
bad movies. Even Stargate, like, he's blend it all up and you get like the result of like, you don't get actual characters, you get character archetypes that all these, you know, actors fall into. So Patrick Wilson plays the, you know, heroic astronaut who has to save the Earth by traveling into the moon.
Love me some Patrick
Halle Berry
Wilson,
plays his tough talking colleague who, you know, is helpful in some way. Speaking of Game of Thrones, John Bradley, the guy who played, Samuel Tarly. Samuel Tarly from Game of Thrones is like the nerd, the science geek who's in this. This movie's ridiculous. Do not see it in theaters, but maybe when it's streaming at home and you can like enjoy it from the comfort of your couch without spending a ton of money, it may be worth a watch. I'm trying to gather energy to write a review of this for Engadget because, oh man, do I just hate so much of this movie. So there's that.
Well, that's it for the episode this week, everyone. Thank you, as always, for listening. Our theme music is by game composer Dale North. Our outro music is by our very own Terrence O'Brien. This podcast is produced by Ben Elman. You can find Devendra online at
Devendra on Twitter and at the Filmcast Podcast at thefilmcast.com.
If you want to send me your favorite awful disaster movies, I'm on Twitter at Sherlyn Lowe. Email us your thoughts at podcast@engadget.com. Leave us a review, please, on iTunes and subscribe on anything that gets podcasts.
There's a studio that works on Call of Duty.
The moon fall, okay?